We gather together for worship this morning, this beautiful summer day, though it's still spring. We're at one service and we're full this morning. So if there's a seat between you and the person next to you, scoot in to make room on the aisles as folks come in. We've got room up here. This is the church thing, right? The last seats left are in the front row. But we've also got room over here. So come on in. We're glad to have everybody here this morning. It's great to be together in community. Thank you for coming this morning. We gather in worship. We gather to wonder and to imagine, to hope, to become. This ritual that we do together, this gathering and singing and song and silence, it's a little weird, right? This thing we do, to take time out of our busy lives to think about stuff and be still. It's a little countercultural in this culture that prizes rushing ahead, argument, division, to come together with people who we don't necessarily always agree with about this, that, or the other, to explore big questions and ask deep thoughts, to seek and offer forgiveness, to hope, to love, to sing in public. All these things are countercultural. And we come so that we might get the strength to be countercultural, to stand up to a culture that is not life-affirming, that is not truth-seeking, to create our own culture and our own way in the world. Thus we gather for worship. Let us worship together.
Good morning. The story I have for you today is called White Flower, and it's based on a true story, something that happened in May of 2007, so almost exactly 8 years ago today. And it's a story about how when you encounter hate and anger, that sometimes the best way to fight back is not by fighting, but by showing love and laughter and joy. The day was bright and sunny, as most May days tend to be in the hills of Appalachia, down in Knoxville, Tennessee. A dozen men put on their suits and took their places in white robes and those tall, pointy hats that hide faces. Their feet fell down in a rhythm as they started their parade. They raised their fists into the air and they bellowed and they brayed. They love to stir people up. They love it when they are taunted. They didn't mind the anger. It's exactly what they wanted. As they came around the corner, sure enough, the people roared. But they couldn't quite believe their ears. It seemed to be support. Had Knoxville finally seen the light? Were people coming round? The men thought for a moment that they'd found their kind of town. But then they turned their eyes to where the cheering had its source, as one of their shoulders crumpled when they saw this mighty force. The crowd, they had painted their faces and they had tacky clothing, their hair and hats outrageous, and they each had bright red noses. The clowns had come out in numbers to enjoy the grand parade, and they laughed and they danced that other clowns had come to town that day. And then the marchers shouted, and the clowns, oh, they strained to hear. One turned intently with a hand cupped to his ear. "White power," screamed the marchers, and they raised their mighty fists. And the clowns, they leaned in, and they listened like they couldn't understand. And one held up his finger and helped all the others see the point of all this yelling, and they joined right in with glee. "White flower," the clowns shouted, and they reached inside their clothes and they pulled out bags and tore them up, and huge clouds of powder rose, and they poured it on each other and they threw it in the air, and they got it all over their baggy clothes and their multicolored hair. Now all but just a few of them were joining in the joke, and you could see the marchers turning red beneath their white cloaks. They wanted to look scary. They wanted to look tough. One rushed in at the clowns in rage and was hauled away in cuffs. But the others, they chanted louder. Marching on around the bend, the clowns all marched on too, of course, supporting their new friends. "White power," came the marcher's cry, and they were not amused. The clowns, they grew silent and thoughtful. Well, perhaps they'd been confused. They huddled, they consulted, this bright and silly crowd. They listened quite intently, and then one said, "Oh, I've got it now. White flowers!" They screamed the happy clown, and all the rest joined in, and the air was filled with white flowers. And they laughed and they danced again. Everyone loves white flowers, and it's a pretty sort. I can't think of a better cause for the people to support. Green flower stems went flying like small arrows from small archers. White petals covered everything, including the very mad marchers. And then a very tall clown called the others to attention. He choked down all his chuckles and he says, "Friends, I have to mention that with all this mirth and fun, it's sort of hard to hear, but now I know the cause of those paraders that they hold so dear." "Tight showers," the clown blurted, and he hid his head in wonder. He held up a camp shower and all the others, they got under. Or at least they tried to get beneath, but strained and they could not. There wasn't room for all of them, and they pushed, but it was tight. Couldn't quite, and there was tight. "White power," came the mad refrain, quite carefully pronounced. The clowns consulted once again, when a woman clown announced, "I've got it! I'm embarrassed that it took me quite so long to see, but what these marchers march for is a cause quite dear to me." "Wife power," she exclaimed, and all the other clowns joined in. They shook their heads and laughed at how erroneous they've been, and the women clowns were hoisted up on the shoulders of the others, and some put on wedding dresses and chanted, "Here's to wives and mothers." The men in robes were sullen, as they knew they'd been defeated. They yelled a few more times, and then they finally just retreated. And when they'd gone, a kind policeman turned to all the clowns and offered them an escort through the center of the town. The day was bright and sunny, as most May days tend to be, in the hills of Appalachia in a town called Knoxville, Tennessee. People joined the new parade, and the crowd stretched out now for miles. The clowns passed out more flowers, and everyone was in smiles. And what would be the lesson of that shiny southern day? Can we understand the message that the clowns sought to convey? Seems that when you're fighting hard, hatred's just not the thing to use. So, here's to those who march on in their big red floppy shoes. The end. Please join me in singing the children downstairs for religious education. It's hymn 118, "This Little Light of Mine."
Thank you. I've been told before that anecdotes are not data. No, they aren't, because anecdotes are better than data. People love a good story. Stories give us something to hold on to. People have been telling stories for as long as there has been speech. The ability to tell stories likely led to tremendous survival advantages for early human groups that achieved it. Language and storytelling played an important role in maintaining the group's well-being. Some scientists have speculated that stories may have given rise to important survival advantages. It literally is natural for us to become emotionally moved by a good story. And when we are emotionally moved, we remember, we file that story away. And this tradition continues today. People don't sit around the campfire swapping data sets. Life is already complex and getting more complicated every day. We want to simplify stuff, and sometimes we just want to hear a good story. So I'm going to tell you a good story. I'm going to tell you the story that I will tell my grandchildren about how their grandfather and I met. And Matthew, I'm going over my 300-word limit because this is my last time as worship associate. In 1998, after college, I backpacked through Europe with my best friend from high school, Aaron. Aaron and I were OCD in high school, so as we aged, we would challenge each other to go on trips where we did things that were spontaneous. We both turned 25 on this trip. We were in Rome for my birthday on June 13th, and 5 days later, on June 18th, we were in Florence for hers. We started the day in the Galleria dell'Accademia, the home of Michelangelo's David. We had carefully avoided American boys on this trip. And you can always recognize American boys in Europe because they're all wearing khaki shorts and running shoes. But as we rounded the gallery behind the famous statue, we saw two American guys in front of a depiction of one of the circles of hell from Dante's Inferno. And unlike most American guys, they were actually stopped in front of the picture discussing it. And from their discussion, we could tell that they had actually read Dante. However, we stayed true to our mantra and we studiously avoided them. Due to traffic flow, we ended up accidentally sort of following them around the museum and exited just after they did. Remembering our rule to act spontaneously, I said to Erin, "Hey, let's follow those guys." And she said, "That is super embarrassing." And I said, "Why? We'll never see them again." So we followed them for about 100 yards, and then we lost them in a crowd that had gathered to see Jerry Springer, who was standing in line in front of the museum to get in, and he had a bimbo on each arm. I cannot make this up. And I said to Aaron, "See, I told you, we're never going to see them again." And we went on through our day, except we did see them again and again, several times randomly through the city, and each time we all pretended that we weren't looking at each other, doing the surreptitious middle school thing where you turn around quick to see if they're looking. It's real smooth. Late in the afternoon, Aaron and I headed back to our hostel to change for dinner. We were supposed to have dinner with a guy we had met earlier, and his name was Davide. He owned a leather store, and he was going to take us to his apartment on his Vespa and cook us dinner, and we were discussing the wisdom of this plan. I know. And I said to Aaron, "Don't worry, we are not going to have dinner with Davide." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Because we're going to have dinner with those two American guys we've been seeing all day." And she said, "You're crazy," and we laughed. But after I was finished getting dressed for dinner, I went over to the window of our room and I pushed open the big wooden shutters and leaned out over the narrow cobblestone street and looked down onto the Via Faenza, because I just had this feeling that we might see them again and maybe they would walk by. But they didn't. Finally, Erin said she was ready, and I pushed myself up from the windowsill, and as I was turning my head back into the room, I saw In the window, directly across the street, the two American guys we had been seeing all day. They had been watching me watch the street. I waved Aaron over to the window and we spent several minutes pretending like we were just standing there for no reason. Finally, one of the boys, his name was David, called across to us, "Have you ladies had dinner yet?" And when we said no, he said, "We'll meet you in the street in 5 minutes." Many bottles of Chianti later, Aaron and David went up to their respective rooms and left Mike and me standing in the Via Faenza until 2 a.m. when the doors of our hostel would be locked. I crept up into our room and Aaron sat up in bed and said, "What were you doing?" And I said, "We were just talking." And she said, "What were you talking about?" And I said, "We were talking about the story we're going to tell our grandchildren about how we met." When Mike got home and developed his pictures of Michelangelo's David, you can see me in the foreground in every one of them before we ever met. And on June 24th, we will be married 15 years. At our wedding, Aaron told the story of the three Davids who brought us together: Michelangelo's David, Mike's friend David, who took him to Europe, and Davide, the leather salesman, who we did not have dinner with, thank God. And our first child, sitting right here, is named David. That, my friends, is an anecdote, and it is not data. Please join me in singing our next song, "We'll Build a Land," number 121.
We'll build a land where we wind up the broken. We'll
last fall's church auction, as I do at most auctions, I put up for bid a sermon topic. The highest bidder gets to choose a book or a poem or a text or a song, and they are often ones that are most exciting to me because I have no idea what it's going to come from. So Alan Penikoff won last year and chose this book by George Lakoff, The Political Mind. And here's a piece from the introduction to share with you, give you a sense of this text. Progressives, Lakoff writes, have accepted an old view of reason, dating back to the Enlightenment, namely that reason is conscious, literal, logical, universal, unemotional, disembodied, and serves self-interest. As the cognitive and brain sciences have been showing, this is a false view of reason. Oddly enough, this matters. It may sound like an academic issue, but this assumption about the nature of reason has stood in the way of an effective progressive defense and advancement of society and democracy. Progressives have ceded the political mind to radical conservatives.
Thank you.
The second reading this morning is a poem by Mary Oliver entitled The Pine Woods. Just before dawn, three deer came walking down the hill, as if the moment were nothing different from eternity. As lightly as that, they nibbled the leaves, they drank from the pond, their pretty mouths sucking the loose silver, their heavy eyes shining. Listen, I did not really see them. I came later and saw their tracks on empty sand. But I don't believe only to the edge of what my eyes actually see in the kindness of the morning. Do you? And my life, which is my body, surely, is also something more, isn't yours? I suppose the deer waited to see the sun lift itself up, filling the hills with light and shadows. They were leaping back into the rough, uncharted pine woods, where I have lived so much of my life, where everything is so quick and uncertain, so glancing, so improbable, so real. I invite you to breathe in and out as we enter together a time of centering and prayer and reflection. First spoken, then silent. Great Spirit of life and love, wondrous power, God of many names, be with us. As we gather in this place and at this time, help us to open our hearts and minds to what we hear and what we feel. The motion of the Spirit that flows through us and each person. We are thankful this morning for life itself, for the gift of this earth, for company and laughter, friendship, music, love, all that is good and decent and pulls us forward into better lives, which is given as a gift. We give thanks. We carry too our sorrows and our pains, our sympathy for one another near and far, our worries for this world that we share together, for the rising floods and the dry lands both. We hold all this in our hearts and resolve ourselves and hope that we might have the courage to do what must be done and the love to do it well. Be with us this day. May we rise to our occasions, be our best selves, and forgive ourselves and others when we are predictably imperfect. Spirit of life and love, hold us in your tender mercy this day and every day. Let us be still, that each might pray or reflect according to your own heart and custom. May the Spirit of life be with us this day and every day. Now let me say, right at the beginning of this sermon, very clearly, I love my mom. She's my mom. She's a good and decent human being. She adores her grandchildren. She raised me in this faith tradition and taught me to love the earth and wild spaces. But the way that she approaches politics distresses me. And it's not because we have different opinions. I am just as much as a flaming liberal as she is, although there are a few issues around the edges where we disagree a little. But mostly, we like the same politicians and the same policy ideas. What distresses me, and I've told her this many times, so I'm not talking behind her back here. She'll probably listen to this sermon online and hear me say these words, so I'm totally upfront. What distresses me is when she says something like, I can't believe that so-and-so conservative would say such-and-such. Sometimes I get text messages. Can you believe what Scott Walker said? How could Jeb be so stupid? It's unbelievable, she sends me this message. Rand Paul's aide licked a reporter's phone and didn't get fired. Stuff like that. That's a true story, by the way. To which I often reply, Mom, stop watching cable news. Just stop. Just stop. For these messages almost always come about 10 minutes into the time slot of Rachel Maddow's cable news show. The outrage machine is up and running. My mom is not unusual in this regard. Of course, indeed, she's very typical. Liberals often think to themselves or say out loud, I don't understand how conservatives can think such stupid, inane, foolish, illogical thoughts. How many of you, be truthful, how many of you have ever thought to yourself or spoken aloud such a notion, how can a conservative think such an illogical thought? Yeah, right. Now, we might think that we liberals, and we're religious liberals here, most of us probably political liberals, but not all of us, and that's an important distinction, the topic for another day slightly, but we might think that we liberals are the only ones to think this way, that we think we are logical, and we find the position of the other side to be illogical. We reason based on facts, on data, while they, the conservatives, decide based on emotion. The book by George Lakoff, The Political Mind, presents more or less this perspective. We, the liberals, he says, are right, but we can't seem to convince the other side of this fact. Why not? He says it's because that they have tapped into the real way we think through stories and metaphors and emotions. And liberals need better stories to compete. We need better metaphors and archetypes and anecdotes. And I think part of what he says is absolutely correct, and I'll come back to that. But I don't want to slip by without challenging the core assumption, at least a little, the idea that it is us liberals who are logical and the conservatives who are not. Because I'll tell you a secret. Don't tell anyone. Shh. Some of my friends are political conservatives. Shh. It's our secret. Don't tell anyone. Some of our members are political conservatives, too. Shh, don't tell anyone. I listen in on their conversations sometimes, and guess what? As crazy as some liberals think that conservatives are, that's just as crazy as some conservatives think that liberals are. Some conservatives think that liberals are illogical, decide based on emotion, and live according to their own sets of facts. It's true. Liberals, thank God, do not have the market cornered on self-righteousness, despite our occasional best efforts to claim that territory for ourselves alone. I think it's in our nature, all people, to believe that we are right and we are logical, that our positions and ideas make sense. I mean, if they didn't make sense, we wouldn't hold them, right? We would change our ideas, so we say. Lakoff and others who look at this kind of thing have learned a lot from behavioral economics. Behavioral economics fascinates me. It used to be that economists believed in rational self-interest, that people would choose to buy things or sell things or act in ways that fit their rational self-interest. You would have to factor in stuff like social prestige and other intangible things. It's not just a simple spreadsheet, it's complicated, but pretty much people would act in their own best interest. And economists took this theory out into the world where it promptly exploded in a plume of smoke and ridiculousness. Because we don't. Do we? We don't act in our rational self-interest. We think we do, sometimes we do, but mostly we don't. So behavioral economics studies what actually motivates us and found all sorts of subtle nudges, the way the room was set up, the power of habit, the metaphorical associations, what our friends do, and so on and so forth. So apply this to politics. Liberals are often confused as to why lower income people might vote conservative. It's not in their economic self-interest. What's the matter with Kansas, as one well-known book on the topic says? Conservatives, by the way, do wonder about us liberals too. How could someone who would really benefit from a tax cut not want one? It boggles their mind. Neuroscience provides the answer. We don't decide things based on facts and figures and logical syllogisms. Our emotions, our hearts, are a vital part of how we make decisions. The stories we tell ourselves and believe about the world, the metaphors and mythical maps we use to make the sense of all the data that comes in, these structures and pathways are how we decide. And this is how it should be. Frankly, if we had to weigh every decision with a full set of facts, if we subjected every vote and purchase and life choice to the fullness of logic, we would be paralyzed and overwhelmed. Decision fatigue, they call it. There's too much to know. And sometimes the answers aren't clear. And sometimes what seems like the answer isn't, and we know in our gut that it's different. We need our instincts, our shortcuts to figure things out, our sense of magic. If Susan had followed logic, the story would not have happened the way it did. Something deeper is true. It turns out that only a few of us are Spocks using logic to decide, and some of us are Dr. McCoys using our best sense of right and wrong, but most of us are Captain Kirks, going with our gut, trying our best and fighting for the people we care most about. And it turns out that we who believe in human dignity and liberty want to convince people to join us, logic is not very effective. But story and emotion and joy and love and hope is. That's what's happening in the story for all ages today, a powerful story, true story. Instead of trying to have a discourse about human genetics, instead of trying to convince them with arguments, instead of playing their game on their rules, send in the clowns. Change the story. Deliberately mishear the hate and replace it with love and laughter. Don't take the hate seriously. Just laugh at it and show that life is better this way. In your red floppy shoes. I love the creativity of those clowns, their courage and their deeper spirit. Let me give you another example. One of the biggest social changes in the last generation is the rapid acceptance of gay and lesbian relationships. It's remarkable. How did it happen? The evidence about this is very clear. What actually changed people's minds was knowing somebody's story, seeing folks as real people. Some 15 or 20 years ago, the strategists who were leading the movement for equality stopped trying to convince people with legal arguments. They had tried and it wasn't working. And they started encouraging folks to come out and tell their story. Tell your story to your family and friends, celebrities and everyday people. And once you know someone's story, you can't dismiss them or condemn them in the same way. This, then, must be our approach if we hope to convince others, change folks' mind in the work for fairness and justice. Lots and lots of young black men and women have died at the hands of law enforcement or quasi-law enforcement in the last 500 years, hundreds of thousands. But what began with the killing of Trayvon Martin and continues with the stories of Tamir Rice and Rika Boyd and Freddie Gray and so many others is a movement, Black Lives Matter, that is more about telling the stories of these persons. Because when you tell the story, folks connect at an emotional level. And the stories are not simple, and they're complicated. Folks who don't want to confront the truths at all contest the truth of the stories. The search high and low to prove that he was not an angel, as if that was enough to warrant death. but we have to tell the stories. If we want to do something about income inequality, charts and facts won't sell it. It has to be a story, a narrative about individual people trying to make ends meet, and a wider story about how we're kin to each other, about community and responsibility and decency. You need a metaphorical vision, something that calls people to a higher understanding. Imagine all the people living as one. You might say, I'm a dreamer. I'm not the only one. A metaphor, a vision. We'll build a land where the captives go free, where justice rolls down like waters. Metaphors and images and stories is what compels and what makes the hard work possible. If we want to do something about climate change, showing a picture of melting ice isn't going to change anyone's mind. And all the science presentations in the world won't convince anyone, which is unbelievably frustrating to scientists, because it isn't how science works, but it is how people work. If we want to get folks to move on this issue, we need to tell the stories of people whose lives are destroyed, whose lands are covered in water or sand. You have to make it real. Tug at the heart, not just the head. You have to make it a moral issue and not just a meteorological one. And now we are in my territory, because now we're talking about religion. Listen, I did not really see them. They came later. I came later and saw their tracks on empty sand. But I don't believe only to the edge of what my eyes actually see in the kindness of the morning. Do you? Can we imagine more than is known for sure? Can we understand that not only do we reason on more than facts, we feel more than we can see? There is a level of intuition, of mystery and wonder, a place where words and concepts fear to tread, a place for poetry instead of prose. What does this have to do with politics or social justice? Everything. Mystery, wonder, awe, a sense of holiness gives a sense of humility. We're part of everything, but we are not everything. The spiritual attitude ought to be one of curiosity and discovery, and not self-assurance. A lot of Americans have turned away from religion in the last generation, and they did so in part because they felt correctly that too much of religion was too cocky, too political, too much about who was right, and not enough about a deeper spiritual yearning for connection. I don't believe only to the edge of what my eyes actually see. A long time ago, I preached a sermon in a different Unitarian Universalist congregation where I said, as part of the sermon, we're not God. We should be humble. And later, after the service, someone said accusingly to me, are you saying there is a God? And I said, I'm not saying that one way or the other. That's an open question. You got to decide for yourself. I'm just saying it ain't us. That's all. Truth is larger than one person's version. It's larger than a set of facts or propositions. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and curiosity is more beautiful than righteousness. If we want to convince each other to support those policies and ideas that we think will make the world more fair and good, we need to get deeper than argument, deeper than a quest for power. We need to get to the heart, our heart and theirs. Many years ago, when I was younger and even more naive, I was talking with a mentor about a difficult problem. I didn't know what to do, and we talked it through for a while. But then he said, Matthew, you can't think your way through this. You have to feel your way through it. You can't think your way through it. You have to feel your way through it. I was terrified by that proposition. Back then, I thought the way that I'd always been taught, that there was a right answer, and with enough cognitive power, you could figure it out. But I learned then, and I have to keep learning over and over and over again, but I keep learning that that's not true. There's a story being lived and being told. every moment of every day. No answers, just stories. No clear and hard truth, just metaphors. No compulsion, just an invitation. No formula, just a vision for a better world, if you can imagine it. No way to stop hate from happening, but there is a way to laugh and to love and live a better life. This then is my invitation to us. Instead of being outraged by what so-and-so said about such-and-such, turn off the cable news and listen to one another. Hear the story from someone else's point of view. Begin with curiosity and humility. The Sufi poet Rumi said, "Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there." Meet one another there. Build a new way. Tell the best stories. Welcome the heart. Don't act like it's not there. Don't abandon facts or science or the search for truth, but always be humble about what we think we know and how we share it. Imagine a better world and share that vision with hope. Believe more than you can see in the kindness of the morning. Let justice roll down like waters. Start with love, that is the seed. Start with love, that is the seed. Let's sing together. I invite you to rise in body or spirit. Please be seated. What a pleasure it is to be together this morning. Thank you for being here. If you're new with us, I hope you checked into the guest table on your way in. If not, please do so on your way out. We have so much going on here at the church, so look in your program for more announcements and ways to get involved and connected with the life of the church. Today, after service, our welcoming congregation renewal team will be showing the short video, No Dumb Questions. It's about trans folks, and if you may have questions, you may have thoughts and ideas, so I encourage you, 11:15, right? Here in the sanctuary. So get some coffee, whatnot, and come on back for that. This afternoon at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in McHenry, Illinois, is Cabaret Church. free and open to the public. Encourage folks to make plans to carpool on over there. There will be music and games and art and folks speaking. I'm talking, I think, at 3:30. I'm on the schedule for just 10 minutes. And all kinds of great stuff, a celebration of art and community and spirituality. So please do join the folks at McHenry for that. It's about an hour's drive, depending on how fast you go, and a beautiful day for a Sunday drive in the country. So come on out. In a moment, we'll take up the offering to support the work of justice and mercy in the world. This morning, we're collecting for GEAR, Grassroots Engagement and Action for Rockford. This is a community organization that we've helped begin to create. It's looking to get off the ground this year and do things. We've had folks going to trainings and events and committee meetings, and one of the players in making this work, they'll be pushing for the kind of justice and fairness that we've been talking about this morning by telling stories and engaging people in grassroots work. So that's what today's offering is for. Next week, I'll be preaching about the idolatry of productivity, a good message as you get ready for summer. We'll also be very productive that day. And as irony is rich with us, we'll be welcoming new members, celebrating our coming of age students, and our annual congregational meeting will be right after that service next week here in this space. We have copies of the agenda and of the detailed budget if you want them. I think they're out on the table in the narthex. If you're curious about that kind of thing and want to read ahead, please pick one of those up. On the 14th of June, we will not be having service here, but I encourage you to come at 10 o'clock so you can carpool with somebody to Marengo, Illinois, where we'll be having a joint worship service with Unitarian Universalists from McHenry and Elgin and DeKalb and Rockton, all together in the park there, and a picnic afterwards. So bring your own chair, bring your own picnic, we'll worship together and then hang out. Hopefully the weather will be like today. We'd love to have you come. That's at 11 o'clock in Marengo, and there are details in the newsletter that'll come out this week. I think that's it for now. So the offering will now be given and received. Thank you. I'll extinguish our chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These things are with us until we are together again. And while we do that, I invite folks to rise in body or spirit, join hands with one another as we prepare for our benedictions. The words of our benediction from the Reverend Sarah Moores Campbell. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. We'll sing together our closing blessing. Go your way in peace. We'll sing it through twice.